Hey friends, this episode of The Fellow on Call is not meant to be used for medical advice and is intended for educational purposes only. Patient information has been modified to ensure privacy. The views expressed in this episode do not necessarily reflect the views of our employers. Enjoy!
Welcome to another episode of The Fellow on Call, the HemOnc podcast. We're coming at you from Reloy University Medical Center. I'm Ronak.
I'm Vivek.
And I'm Dan.
And in today's episode, we continue on our colorectal cancer series, this time focusing on radiation oncology and the role that radiation plays in the management of our patients. And we're super excited. We don't want to delay it too much, but we do have a special guest with us on this episode, Dr. Nina Sanford, coming to us from UT Southwestern. And we'll let her introduce herself when we roll the show. Guys, how awesome was it recording this episode with Nina?
Absolutely incredible. We had a really good discussion, go through rectal cancer radiation, but also at the end, have a lot of good nuggets where we talk about endpoints. And I think sticking through this episode, listening to it, it's just great.
Yeah, we were really lucky to get Dr. Sanford on with us. I'm so excited for this, for our listeners to have this episode.
All right, guys. Well, let's not delay it any further. On to the episode we go. You guys, today we're so excited to have a special guest with us in our colorectal cancer series, this time talking all about radiation treatments for patients with colorectal cancer. Today we're joined by Dr. Nina Sanford, who is an assistant professor and chief of gastrointestinal radiation oncology services at UT Southwestern Medical Center in Dallas, Texas. Nina, thank you so much for taking the time to join us today.
My pleasure. Happy to be here.
You know, we always start our shows by asking our guests one fun fact about themselves. So what would you say is your fun fact?
So my fun fact is that I now for about 15 months have had a pet bunny. His name is Tutu, even though that sounds like a feminine name. It's actually a boy, but Tutu means bunny rabbit in Mandarin. The breed is a mini lop. However, I feel like we were fooled by the breeder because bunny has actually become quite large. But this is the first pet that I've had and that my children have had. It's an interesting experience.
That's really exciting. Yeah, I had a rabbit growing up as well. I think they're great pets.
I think Dan subscribed to some sort of a bunny. I don't know if it's a blog or a magazine. Dan, can you tell us about this?
It was the Journal of the House Rabbit Society. It was, I think, either monthly or semi-monthly.
I'm shocked that that's a thing, but strangely not surprised. One, that something like that exists, and two, that Dan Hausrath ever subscribed to a journal like that.
Dan Hausrath would definitely subscribe to that. It makes complete sense.
Trying to convince Logan that we should get a Flemish giant, which is a very, very large breed of rabbit.
All right, Dan.
Listeners, we'll keep you posted on if that ever happens. I think Vivek and I will need to talk to Logan ourselves to hear his perspective on the whole situation. Once again today, we're talking all about the role of radiation oncology as part of our colorectal cancer series. And, you know, we've had radiation oncologists in the past on our show for different types of tumors. And it is just always so insightful as people that do medical oncology to hear the thought process that you guys have when you're evaluating your patients, to hear what the process feels like, what that experience is like for your patients. And so, Nina, we're super excited to have you here with us again today. So, Vivek, do you want to start us off with a case?
Yeah, let's do it. So let's say we have a 68-year-old male, and he initially presented to his primary care provider, had some change in his bowel habits, had some rectal bleeding. He underwent a CT scan, and he had some rectal thickening suspicious for a mass. After that, he had a colonoscopy, and that showed an 8-centimeter distal rectal mass that was less than 1 centimeter from the anal verge, and this was biopsied and found to be an adenocarcinoma. He ended up undergoing an MRI of the pelvis, which was consistent with T4B N0M0 disease with a CT of the chest as well. So at this point, he was discussed in a multidisciplinary tumor board, and we're going to get into the nitty-gritty of all of this in this episode today. Neoadjuvant capecitabine was recommended, followed by chemoradiation and surgery. What I want to do is start off with one thing. So we have this patient here. There is an 8-centimeter distal rectal mass, less than a centimeter from the anal verge. One thing we always hear is low-lying tumors, and we always hear that. And just from the perspective of the radiation oncologist, what do you consider as a low-lying tumor, and how does that change the way you think about a patient?
That's a great question. Yeah. So let me just give you sort of a 10,000-foot overview, I think, of like colorectal versus rectal cancer. And this is also how I talk to my patients about the two cancers. So colorectal cancer, we think of as one entity sort of, but because they're similar sort of biologically, obviously you guys know there are differences between right and left-sided colon cancers, but they're all adenocarcinomas for the most part, but they're very different anatomically. We think of the colon as sort of, I tell my patients, kind of like in the free-floating belly, kind of in the intestine, versus the rectum sits in the pelvis, which, you know, is that bowl-shaped structure with a hole at the bottom. And why that is important for radiation oncologists and for local therapy, and it goes into your question about the low-lying tumors, is that for colon cancers, surgery is generally first because they're easy to take out, you can reconnect, and you can get a negative margin. Whereas for radiation, surgery is often last or maybe not needed at all. And that's because it's harder to obtain a negative margin when you're in the narrow pelvis. In males who don't have children, it can be as narrow as 5 centimeters. And also, a surgery can entail a permanent colostomy, particularly for these distal low-lying tumors. So when I think about the rectum and the anal canal is obviously the distal part of the GI tract. The rectum sits above there. The anal canal is about 4 centimeters. The rectum is upper, mid, lower, each is about 4 to 5 centimeters. The best way to identify it is on an MRI, like on the sagittal view. You can kind of see the anal canal crook back. But anyway, that's just some background. But getting back into your question about what I think of as a low-lying tumor, it's basically a tumor that would probably require an APR, because functionally, that's the most important part for a patient. There's also such a thing called a coloanal anastomosis, which they do reconnect, but it's with lower tumors, and the functional outcomes are not quite as good as LAR, but they don't have a permanent colostomy. So I think of low-lying tumors also as sometimes needing a coloanal anastomosis.
All right. So thank you for going over that. So when you're seeing a new patient with locally advanced rectal adenocarcinoma, how do you decide whether or not they would be a good candidate for concurrent chemoradiation?
That is a big question. I think the first thing to realize is that locally advanced rectal cancer is very heterogeneous in many different ways. So like historically, we think of anything T3, T4 node positive as locally advanced, but that encompasses like a really wide range of presentations. So the case you had was T4 low lying. That is very different than a small posterior non-obstructing upper rectal T3 N0 tumor. And those are all locally advanced and included in the historic trials. We know that most of these patients do need chemotherapy, but your question is about local therapy. There are really two, surgery or radiation. And I think as we go in more into today, we'll see that there's really been a push to use just one local modality, either surgery or radiation when feasible, to try to sort of optimize quality of life. I think the first question of whether or not you need radiation is the intent of treatment. So if the intent is organ preservation, non-operative management, then we know that we need radiation as a local treatment. And I know we'll get a lot more into that. However, if it is preoperative intent and there is a plan for surgery, then it's a little bit more complicated. But generally, I think scenarios where we would advocate for radiation would be for a T4 tumor, like your patient. If the tumor was encroaching the mesorectal fascia, so obviously the mesorectum is like this case that the rectum sits in. If it's touching upon that, there's a risk of a positive margin. We want to add radiation. If there's an extensive lymphadenopathy, particularly what we call lateral pelvic nodes, which are outside the mesorectum, so along the obturator chain or the internal iliac, those can be harder to access surgically. We want to add radiation. And then extramural venous invasion, which is also a risk factor for distant recurrence. But if a scan shows that, then we sometimes also add radiation as well. In contrast, sort of at the upper end of the spectrum, if we have a small T3A, T3B, mid-upper rectal tumor, and they're a candidate for LAR, then radiation omission may be appropriate. So that's kind of like a broader review, but I think we'll get into some of the studies showing that as well.
That's really helpful. And the other, I think we're just sort of going through some of the terminology just to wet our palates a little bit in the beginning. And so one of the other things that comes up quite often is we hear things like long course and short course radiation. We'll, again, get into this in a little bit more detail. But what is long course? What is short course? What is really a difference between these? And how do we pick which one to go with?
I love getting to the basics. It actually took me a while to realize that FOLFIRINOX and FOLFOXIRI were like the same drugs. And then I was like, oh, I mean, I know the doses are different, but sometimes you like hear terms. The other person thinks, oh, obviously, you know what that means. But like, if you've never learned, you might never know. Anyway, so just we're on the same page. So long course radiation is generally concurrent with either 5-FU or a CAPE. It's chemo radiation. It's 1.8 to 2 gray per day for about 5 to 6 weeks. The total gray is about 50.4 to 54 gray. Short course radiation is higher dose per fraction, so 5 gray per day times 5 to a total of 25 gray. That's done over 1 week. Not getting into all the details, but if you give a higher dose in one treatment, that's more biologically effective than smaller doses over longer periods of time. So it's not like 25 gray is half the total dose of the 50 gray. It's like probably 2/3 or 3/4 of the dose. It's a little bit lower, but it's not half. Now, just emphasize, we're going in the preoperative setting, which is where most of the trials of short course have been. So basically, the historic trials showed no significant difference in local recurrence between short versus long course in the preoperative setting. So there were the POLIS trial, a TROG trial. They had about 300 patients or so each. They were published like 10 or 20 years ago. They showed that they're the same in the preoperative setting. There was a more recently published trial called the RAPIDO trial. That was comparing so-called standard treatment, which is long course chemorad, surgery, and adjuvant chemotherapy versus total neoadjuvant therapy starting with chemotherapy and then short course radiation. What the study found is that with longer follow-up, the local recurrence risk was higher with short course radiation than long course chemo radiation. The most important thing to know about the RAPIDO trial is that these were really high-risk patients. So kind of like the risk factors I talked about, they were T4, they had EMBI, their tumors were encroaching the mesorectal fascia, or they had lateral lymph nodes. You had to have one of those features to qualify for that trial. At 5 years follow-up, the local recurrence rate was longer with short course radiation than long course chemo radiation. And there have been some hypotheses of why. Is it dose? Is it longer interval to surgery, et cetera? But I think with publication of that trial, sort of the pendulum swung back a little bit towards long course chemo radiation. You have to remember this was published around the time of COVID, where people were kind of going to short course. And then this came out and people were like, wait, let's pause. Let's maybe do long course. So after that came out, some people were like, is there any role for short course at all anymore? Like, should we just abandon it forever, right? A couple things to note. One, around the world, predominantly short course is actually used. We're actually an outlier in using long course chemo radiation. Two, if we're talking about omission of radiation, then I think there has to be a room for short course. Like, we can't just go from nothing to the 5 weeks. There is room for some sort of moderation in the middle. So I think scenarios where I think short course is reasonable are basically if they do not have the high-risk features of the RAPIDO trial, which I talked about, which are high-risk features for local recurrence. If the patient is elderly, coming for 5 weeks is really, really tough. And we know that in clinical trials, they disproportionately enroll ECOG 0/1 younger patients, right? They're not representative of the patients we see with colorectal cancer. There is actually a randomized trial that did not get a lot of press, Rodige, I think 42, that showed that long course chemo radiation actually decreased survival in elderly patients. It was not powered for that. And they actually looked at some functional outcomes, which were actually significant as well. But the point is, if you have an older patient, coming for 5 weeks can be really, really tough. And the last scenario, which is not directly applicable to a locally advanced setting, but in patients with metastatic cancer, if we're trying to go the definitive route, if they've limited disease, then we really try to minimize the time off systemic therapy. Then short course, if we can do it, may be appropriate. So I definitely think there is room for short course. It's become a little bit less popular, especially with more non-op intent treatment, which we'll talk about.
One question about the short course versus long course there. So the RAPIDO trial, I think, was huge, which really gave us really good data and to really suggest that, hey, we should be considering doing this long course radiation in the right patient population. Toxicity-wise, side effect profile-wise, if I were a patient, I could come in and say, hey, look, doc, 5 days sounds a lot better than 5 weeks. What's the difference and how do you counsel the patient that might ask you that question? And the other question to that is, do you offer both to your patients in that initial counseling session?
That's a good question. Do I offer both? I do. I think my experience with patients, the majority of my patients prefer for me to have a recommendation favoring one way or the other. So I try to really gather what their preferences are, particularly with regards to non-operative management, what kind of the logistics are. If they're really deciding between the two and it's like really hard for them to come for 5 weeks, or they could have one or the other, then I let them know that there is equipoise in many scenarios to do that. So they don't feel like, you don't want them to feel bad. You don't want to be like, oh, I'm like not coming for 5 weeks. I'm like, you know, like hurting my cancer care. So I think usually I try to make a recommendation one way or the other. But if I can really tell that they really can't come for 5 weeks, I let them know that short course is okay as well. In terms of side effects, I'm glad you asked that question. When I think of side effects between long and short course, I think of the side effects from long course radiation as much more predictable. And short course is less predictable. I'm going to go into that a little bit more. So one thing is long course chemo radiation, you're seeing them over the 5 weeks. So you kind of can like manage the side effects as they happen. And it kind of follows usually a similar trajectory in that the first 2 weeks are fine. Starting in the third week, they have some diarrhea. They have some maybe urgency, some urinary urgency. And then if for a distal tumor, their skin may become irritated. That really peaks around the fourth and fifth week, and then they get better. Those acute side effects get better a few weeks after. Short course, I tell patients that during the treatment, they may have like no side effects. It's over so quickly, but the side effects may come like a week or two after. So I just warn them that this may pop up like when you're done with us, and don't be alarmed. It's somewhat expected. And I help them manage it. And I say, reach out to our office so we can help you manage it. Short course radiation, I also felt is less predictable because I agree the majority of patients do really, really well. But then I do have a small subset who actually get pretty severe symptoms after the treatment. And the most bothersome one is something called tenesmus, which, as you know, is basically like spasming of the anal canal. They feel like they have to go to the bathroom all the time, but nothing comes out. It can actually be extremely bothersome. Bentyl, which is an antispasmodic, and sometimes steroids can be helpful. I tell patients that it's not dangerous and it resolves, but it can be really bothersome. So yeah, short course, less predictable, happens after radiation's over. Long course happens during treatment, somewhat easier to manage.
Yeah, that's a really helpful overview. And just a great reminder that in general with radiation-based therapy, you really do think about a lag in onset of these toxicities, and that, you know, it's a lag in delay, and then it's a lag in resolving as well. To change gears here a little bit, when we think about sequencing, that's always a key thing in oncology care. When we're thinking about sequencing chemotherapy or chemoradiation, which patients do you think should start with chemoradiation up front prior to chemotherapy or vice versa? There were some interesting results from the OPRA trial, if I remember correctly, that suggested that there were better pathologic CR when doing chemoradiation first, followed by consolidation with chemotherapy. But I just wanted to hear your thoughts on it.
So the OPRA trial is the largest, really the largest published randomized trial we have on organ preservation as of 2024. So this was a multi-institutional series led out of Memorial Sloan Kettering, where patients were randomized, just as you said, to either initial long-course chemoradiation followed by chemotherapy versus the exact inverse. So starting with chemotherapy followed by long-course chemoradiation. And they found that when you started with chemoradiation, you had higher rates of organ preservation. That was seen also at 5 years follow-up. An interesting tidbit about that is that 99% of recurrences, if they went to surveillance, were caught within the first 3 years. So that's really the highest risk window to surveil patients closely to look for local recurrence. But anyway, so yeah, the winning arm for organ preservation was starting with chemoradiation first. Generally, based on those results, we do tend to start with chemoradiation versus chemotherapy, especially if the intent is organ preservation. But the study also showed reassuringly that if you started with radiation, you didn't compromise the compliance to chemotherapy rate. So it's not like, you know, these patients do need chemotherapy, and they have a table that looks at number of cycles of chemo received, whether or not you started with chemotherapy or started with radiation, and there was no difference. So I think it's reassuring that if you get chemoradiation first, it doesn't mean you're going to not get chemo, because we know that the predominant form of recurrence in these patients is systemic. So they definitely need the chemotherapy. There are some scenarios where we do advocate for chemotherapy first. I think if there is a really high suspicion that the patient has occult metastatic cancer, really extensive lymphadenopathy, like N2 disease, nodes going up the iliac, which is non-regional, if they have a really high CA, or if there's like a long lag to starting treatment from their initial diagnosis, and you're like, okay, I really think they might have metastatic cancer, and maybe we can treat them with chemo and spare them the toxicity of local treatment if they're just going to progress, then in those cases, we might consider starting with chemotherapy. But at least at our institution, most patients are starting with chemoradiation.
That's super helpful to think about. And I really like the point that you make about how do we sort of go off of being so dogmatic, right? You have to take the whole picture into perspective. These high-risk features that you started our discussion with today, I think are good things, if I'm not mistaken, just to keep in our minds when we're having these discussions to figure out who may benefit from chemotherapy first. Talking about another major trial, the PROSPECT trial was also recently published. That showed that neoadjuvant FOLFOX was non-inferior to concurrent chemoradiation followed by surgery. And so, as we know, as we also discussed, there's a lot of selection bias when it comes to patients in this study. But this patient population was highly selected with a majority of T3 patients who were amenable to low anterior resection, that LAR that we've been talking about. Patients were also excluded if they were less than 3 millimeters, if their tumor was less than 3 millimeters from the mesorectal fascia. So, what do you make of this trial as a radiation oncologist? And are there patients who you would consider deferring radiation therapy for?
Like you said, prospect radiation omission trial, non-inferiority study, select patients, couldn't be T4, could not require APR, and patients who had like at least a 20% response of FOLFOX and went straight to surgery without radiation, their disease-free outcomes, survival outcomes were non-inferior. So going back, yes, there are definitely a subset of patients with locally advanced rectal cancer, locally advanced rectal cancer, sort of the less advanced ones that don't need radiation. I think there are some points, though, to make about the PROSPECT trial. And I think it really highlights this trial was conceived in the early 2000s. It really actually emphasizes how the practice patterns and thinking about rectal cancer have like really changed since then. And sort of the difficulty, I think, in doing a trial, even if it's amazingly well done, when standards of care are changing. So the first thing is that many patients who were eligible for PROSPECT would actually already qualify for upfront surgery. So based on ASTRO and ESMO guidelines, if you're an early T3 tumor, a mid or upper rectal tumor, your tumor is not encroaching the mesorectal fascia and you don't have EMVI, those are patients that our Radiation Oncology Society would recommend for consideration of upfront surgery. Now we know, as you guys know, with the IDEA trial and other trials, there's thought about de-escalation of adjuvant chemotherapy in rectal cancer. So a lot of these patients, I would actually recommend for upfront surgery and de-escalation of chemotherapy, potentially depending pathologic findings. And those recommendations are based on a series of prospective studies showing that if you have an MRI-defined good prognosis tumor and you go straight to surgery, your risk of local recurrence is actually very, very low. The second thing about PROSPECT is that the experimental arm actually got a lot of FOLFOX. So if you look in the supplemental table, a high proportion of patients got 10 to 12 cycles of FOLFOX. They actually don't break it down exactly by number of cycles. Proportion got a certain number in neoadjuvant and adjuvant, but these patients actually got a lot of FOLFOX. It's actually more than the NCCN's recommendations, which is about 6 to 8 cycles of chemotherapy. So that just goes to my first point about if you can do surgery first and then potentially scale back on chemotherapy, that could save toxicity. The main thing is that this trial was conceived in an era where non-operative management was not something that was done. So these are all patients treated with pre-op intent. Now, these are upper rectal tumors that did not require an APR, so organ preservation may be less important for those patients, but it was really not a consideration for the study. So with that being said, our practice is either really a patient can get upfront surgery, or we kind of go more the total neoadjuvant organ preservation route. But I think PROSPECT gives us confidence that if we have a patient that for some reason started with chemotherapy, they fit the criteria, they have a good response, then they may not need radiation, preoperative radiation. I think Deb Schrag, who presented the trial at ASCO here a couple years ago, made a really good sort of conclusion that it's really about toxicity trade-offs. In rectal cancer, we now have many treatment options that have the same survival. I mean, I was telling patients, you have a lot of different treatment options. None we think has worse survival. That wouldn't be fair to you to offer that, but it's really toxicity trade-offs. So I really like that the same day that PROSPECT was presented, the clinical outcomes were published in New England Journal and the pro outcomes were published in JCO like on that same day. And clearly sexual function was worse with radiation. So if you have a young woman who wants to maintain her fertility or someone for whom that is extremely important, then this might be a good regimen. Those are my thoughts on the PROSPECT trial. I think it was a great study, but worth considering some of the nuances.
Going along the lines of that, one thing that I've always thought is the toxicity when thinking about a surgical resection versus just non-operative management in general, that trade-off of actually having to go through surgery versus just doing chemotherapy and chemoradiation. So from your perspective, you see a lot of patients now, I'm sure, that we're thinking more about this non-operative management. We see them when we give them chemotherapy. You see them after chemo radiation. But in terms of long-term follow-up for these patients who choose the non-operative management route, how are they doing in terms of side effects? And I know it's hard to compare to those without a good study to those who ended up getting surgery for long-term outcomes. But in general, what are your thoughts on organ preservation? Do you think this is the route that we should be going in? Which patient do you think we should really be shooting for, the ideal patient for organ preservation?
So I think patients, the ones I've talked to, definitely are very excited about organ preservation. We're seeing more young patients with colorectal cancer, particularly rectal cancer. If there is a trade-off between getting a colostomy, I think most patients would choose the organ preservation route. That being said, as I kind of alluded to, it's really about measuring quality of life and different toxicities between the different strategies. I did have a patient who had a very distal tumor, and initially she almost had an excisional biopsy that compromised her anal sphincter function. So even though she actually was able to have a complete response to our treatment, I think because of that initial surgery, she was already having problems with incontinence. Actually, in the end, she chose to get a colostomy, and that actually improved her quality of life. So, you know, it's not totally black and white one way or the other, but I think patients are definitely interested in organ preservation. I think OPERA is the biggest study that we have now, but there are many studies coming down the line that may help us tailor the best strategy. So the JANUS trial is a study looking at FOLFIRINOX versus FOLFOX with organ preservation intent. So that will let us know if a triplet chemotherapy can improve the response rates. And then we mentioned short versus long course radiation. So a German trial, I think with, I want to say like over 1,000 patients, has finished accruing comparing short versus long course radiation with organ preservation intent. And those also have good sort of long-term sort of, hopefully we'll have long-term quality of life capturing.
The other question I have is for patients, you know, let's say you're for the new medical oncology fellows and other people, they undergo chemo radiation. Are they having these long-term, is it where the tumor is lying that tells you if the patient's going to have some of these more long-term tenesmus symptoms, things like that, long-term side effects from radiation?
When the patient also gets surgery, it's hard to separate the long-term side effects of radiation versus surgery. But I generally do think patients with more distal cancers just tend to have more symptoms because that's where you have more function in terms of continence. Another question patients ask me is, will radiation make me incontinent? And I say generally no, because the dose of radiation that we deliver is lower than the nerve tolerance. So radiation itself should not make you long-term incontinent. But if the initial tumor is causing incontinence and it's already sort of damaged the nerves, then sometimes radiation can reverse that. So a lot of it also depends on the degree of symptoms they're initially having and whether or not we think there's like nerve damage from that. The reason why I'm hedging is we really do need better long-term outcomes, particularly symptom outcomes in these organ preservation cases.
That makes a lot of anatomic sense. So like things that are lower down, like you alluded to, are going to be starting to interfere with those really complex sensory networks, these sort of feedback systems that the distal rectum and the anal canal have to all this stool sensing and these other components of continence that we don't actively think about. If it's interfering with that, it makes sense that it would have long-term impact. Just to shift gears again a little bit, thinking about metastatic disease. When I was early in training, just getting into the world of oncology, I had still in my head that, okay, metastatic disease, we're not thinking curative anymore. We're thinking this is something that patient's going to have for life. But it seems that in the rectal cancer world and a few other types of cancer, but in the rectal cancer and colon cancer world, there's this entity oligometastatic disease, where the idea is that we have one or two metastatic sites and potentially this could be curative. So when you're thinking about oligometastatic disease, how many sites do you consider constituting oligometastatic? Is there like an upper limit? And how can we sort of, is this something we could definitively address with radiation?
The concept of oligometastatic is not new, but it's a moving target. The first thing is that when we think about what oligometastatic cancer is that we want to identify a patient subset where the visible lesions are amenable to local therapy, but are not a harbinger of like much more extensive disease to come very soon. Because even if you can treat them, they progress very soon after you have really helped them. So you're kind of trying to predict the future. The first thing I think of is not necessarily the number of sites, but really the timing of development of those mets. So if a patient finishes definitive treatment and then very soon after they sprout some new spots. Even if they're a couple, that's probably a sign that they have more aggressive biology and probably is not a good idea to treat them with local therapy. Now, if a patient has undergone treatment and then on a surveillance scan years later, something pops up, then that could suggest more indolent biology. And sometimes we just treat those with radiation or surgery and actually don't do anything else. Now, obviously, if a patient presents with primary tumor and several sites, well, you don't know when those came up, and then you're kind of rolling the dice. But those may be cases that would be amenable to local therapy after initial interval of chemotherapy. So you always want to do chemotherapy first. So in terms of number of sites and location, there's no magic cutoff, but I generally think of 3, maybe up to 5 in the liver and the lung. Those tended to be the most common sites for which curative therapy might be reasonable. Now, sort of the poster child for curative treatment in the stage 4 setting was colon or colorectal cancer spread to liver that was removed with surgery. So I think liver and lung, maybe 3 up to 5. I think if a patient had peritoneal mets, even if you only see one, brain mets, even bone mets, those are really signs of more aggressive tumors that even if they're potentially amenable, they're probably going to develop other sites of disease pretty soon after. So yeah, to answer your question, maybe 3 up to 5, but you want to look at the time course and location as well. There is a currently enrolling randomized trial through the cooperative groups called ERASURE, which looks at this specifically. So it's patients with metastatic colorectal cancer who have 4 to 6, who've gotten like, I think, 4 to 6 months of chemo, and they can have 4 sites of metastatic cancer. So even more than that many spots, but 4 sites. And you might wonder why that's so lenient. Well, it's challenging to accrue to these studies, as you can be aware of. People, for a lot of reasons, very challenging to accrue to radiation trials. And I could talk about that for like a whole podcast episode of why and how we can potentially solve that. They needed the criteria to be a little bit more lenient to have more patients on. So it's a little bit more lax than what I would consider oligometastatic. But we really need level 1 evidence in this space. And unfortunately, the longer we treat one way or the other without that evidence, the harder it is to establish it. So if you have that trial open at your center, definitely consider enrolling on it. I think we need to generate better evidence. But it's something that I think, this is sort of a separate topic, which is like endpoints and studies of radiation trials. But I do think we are treating these sites in patients who are kind of slowly sprouting one site and another. It's possible we prolong survival. That'd obviously be amazing. But I think it is, for the most part, a low toxicity treatment that can keep them out of the hospital, potentially keep them off of chemotherapy, keep them from being a patient. And I think that can be very valuable to patients with metastatic cancer who've really received a lot of treatment.
I think you touched on a lot of really important things. In terms of oligometastatic disease, the timing, when does this come up? When did it pop up is really important. And the second thing is there's no, and to your point of radiation trials versus our trials, there's no accelerated pathway for approval for radiation, right? It doesn't have this, now we have this accelerated approval for this new drug because there's a response rate. And I think to your point too, one of the things that we see, and we talk a lot about this in our other episodes, when we review the papers in medical oncology from our end, we look at things like disease-free survival and progression-free survival. And I think there's a stigma attached often when we think about radiation studies that even as medical oncologists, we talk about this with each one of our radiation oncologists to say that, hey, look, our toxicities are pretty bad. Your toxicities can be the same or better in some cases and for shorter durations. And I think that that's a really important thing for our listeners to understand, and that we need to rethink I think what we've done is said, let's scrap away all radiation. And I see a lot of Hodgkin lymphoma, for example, and things like that. And we've kind of just said, toss radiation aside without good randomized evidence in some of these things. So I think it's really important. I think enrolling on those trials is critical. I think, honestly, radiation oncologists do a little bit better job than we do with design of the trials. But that all makes a whole lot of sense to me. And I think that each one of our listeners should really take that last bit that you just said. And we do need to enroll in these studies. We shouldn't overtreat thousands of patients for the next 15 years, and we could find the answer fairly quickly if we just enrolled patients at enough centers.
Agree with everything you just said. I love it.
I want to just tack on to Vivek's comments. I thought everything that we talked about was so insightful and so helpful. I just want to turn over the mic to you as we're wrapping up today. What final thoughts do you have? Any reminders for our listeners about when we're referring patients over to radiation oncology, or just general pearls of wisdom in the spirit of you already dropping tons of nuggets of knowledge throughout our episode today?
Gosh, that is a really, really good question. I think rectal cancer is a multidisciplinary team sport. I really am excited about all the sort of advancements that we've had and sort of the different strategies. But enrolling on clinical trials is really the only way that we'll really be able to rigorously test one treatment over the other. In terms of radiation oncology specifically, what I'm excited about in the future is really personalizing and tailoring radiation dose to the specific tumor. And this is something that I think medical oncologists have done a really good job of. You have targeted treatments for different colorectal cancers, and you're going to treat a BRAF tumor differently, a KRAS mutated tumor wild type differently than a non. I think that is where I hope to see radiation oncology go. Sort of right now, a lot of the radiation treatment plans are made at the outset, and they kind of get the whole treatment the whole time. We don't really account for any changes in the tumor. So something that we are working on is really adapting the radiation to biologic response. So I think with that, I think radiation is now one dose, you know, short or long course. We're overtreating and undertreating patients. You know, we're not getting to the sweet spot of the majority of patients. So my hope is that with better sort of personalization of radiation, better interfacing and multidisciplinary efforts with MedOnc and surgery, we can really optimize quality of life with these patients for rectal cancer. So really, really capturing the endpoints that are most meaningful to patients. And I think we're doing, I think actually rectal cancer is leading that way across GI cancers, maybe across all cancers, which I know less about, really valuing quality of life, patient-reported outcomes. I feel like with all the new treatments with rectal cancer, that is really at the forefront. And eliminating either radiation or surgery to try to optimize long-term functional outcomes. So emphasizing that more and really collecting the data on it so we actually know what patients are feeling 10, 15, 20 years later, since now they're living longer, will be really, really important.
And, you know, I think that's so critical. And we talked about our stage 3 and stage 2 adjuvant colon cancer. We talked about oxaliplatin. That is not a fun drug. The neuropathy is real. That's why the IDEA collaboration happened. And what are we willing to tolerate to give up in a little bit of disease-free survival to improve some of these quality of life metrics? So rectal cancer is really doing, I mean, it was amazing to see that JCO paper.
So if you ask patients what they value in terms of outcomes, it can be very different than oncologists. So at GI ASCO, Miriam Chalabi presented a slide where it's like what clinicians value and what patients value. And they were almost like in the exact reverse. This is specific to rectal cancer. So exactly what you said, like, you know, the disease-free survival percentages, when you actually present that to a patient, you know, what are these endpoints? How do they translate to how I feel? Sometimes their answers might surprise you. So like really asking what patients value is really important.
This is what all of our listeners, somebody here is going to do research in this field, right? There's more to do than just clinical trials nowadays in medical oncology and radiation oncology and surgery. Capturing these endpoints, it's very hard to do. We need to figure out how to do it. That's how the field's going to move forward. So I think that's a good way to wrap up the episode today. Thank you so much for joining on this episode. We love our radiation oncology episodes, love our surgery episodes. So I think, I'm not sure the order we're releasing this, but listen to the surgery episode, listen to it again. If you haven't listened to it, listen to it. It's going to be great.
Thank you.
All right, guys. So until next time, we'll see you all later.
See you later.
Peace.